Russell Wilson is much like Patrick Mahomes is against the Raiders, undefeated against the Minnesota Vikings. He's 6-0 against the Vikings, including the playoffs. So I really don't see where this is going to change. I mean, they like to throw the ball all over the lot. Minnesota secondary has been struggling this year. DK Metcalf is one of his big targets now. I just don't see where Minnesota can go to Seattle and win this game.
It's awfully, awfully negative from Keyshawn Johnson.
A simple wrong would have done just fine.
ESPN Radio. I will take one issue with everything he said there was mostly correct. Let's just be honest. But I'll take one issue and say that that playoff win by Russell Wilson over the Vikings, Mike Zimmer got the better of Russell Wilson that day, and Blair Walsh missed a 27-yard field
goal. The weather did.
Yeah.
The weather got him. On the worst. And then it got Blair Walsh.
Yeah. I mean, that was like 7 years ago, too, so, or whatever.
How about this small thought? Adrian Peterson, hold on to football.
That would help, too. Yeah, although it was like 30 below zero, so.
One of the worst days of my life.
See if any of us can hold on to the football in those conditions. But we're going to dive into Judd's keys to a Vikings victory and action movie rewind, plus a wrap with Royce on this episode of Mackie and Judd. And a quick word for Federated, Federated Mutual Insurance Company. They're now on Twitter, too. They're tweeting up a storm. You can find fresh, relevant risk management content at Federated INS, at Federated INS. On Twitter, and you can check out this month's Risk Management Corner article addressing fire prevention. Fire Prevention Awareness Week is this week, and this year's theme is Find Fire Before Fire Finds You. At Federated Mutual Insurance Company, it's our business to protect yours.
TCL is a proud sponsor of the Score North Studios. Enjoy more of the things you love with TCL. These two guys have Minnesota sports flowing in their veins. Mackie and Judd on Score North and ScoreNorth.com.
You got to just do it, you know. they're both really good players, and especially when Russell gets out of pocket, obviously, to make plays on the run. But that's a challenge that we face, and I'm excited for that challenge, and I know our young guys are as well.
You know, when a team plays pretty much the same defense for the most part of the game, they know what teams are trying to do to attack them. So they basically just kind of let everybody stay in front of them, and then they attack the ball. And you see it over and over on film that you know, once the ball is thrown, they're going full speed for the ball and you know, hitting guys and being physical, and you see that day week in and week out.
That was Eric Kendricks. You heard from Adam Thielen there talking about how the Seahawks play the same defense all the time, and it's really not working that well for them, but they have Russell Wilson and DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett, so they just score a bunch of points.
Is Eric Kendricks going to play in this game?
Well, this is what he said about his foot.
Okay. Not really. You know, doing well, doing better. Obviously, had some issues with it, but feeling hopeful.
I think he's going to play. I think he's going to try to play.
I was going to say he's going to try to play, but he has not practiced this week, which is a big deal if you miss the Wednesday and Thursday practice. Interesting. Again, I would just say this. Is it worth it? Is it worth it? Is it smart? Are you being smart?
Well, I think if you're insinuating like, oh my God, he could like injure his foot for the rest of his career, like that's one conversation.
Oh, no. I'm saying, is it smart? I'm just throwing it out there. Listen, if you know how to tank, you know how to tank. But we never use that word. If you know how to be smart, it's more important. Is it smart?
You're like a mafia goon or something.
Yeah.
You sure? Hey, you
Richie.
Hey, you sure you want to do that?
Want to do that?
Is that a smart move?
Is that a good idea?
Not you want to do that? I'm not sports dad for nothing, you two. Okay?
That's something you want to do here?
It's the best move.
You want to sit down there, Kendricks?
Tony Soprano?
You want to try to play through this foot injury? Is that what you want to do?
This is the best move. Mike Zimmer? Is that
Russell
the best
Wilson,
move?
You see him play? He's an MVP. You want to do this? You're going to lose. Don't do it.
Thank you, Declan. That's very good. That's perfect.
That was pretty good. That was pretty good. All right.
Declan, the skinniest, weakest mafioso lord of all time. You're supposed to be fat and big.
Declan's the brains in the mafia.
Yeah.
I'm not the brawn.
He's the kid.
I'm the Fredo of these three.
So how's Judd's keys doing here after the Vikings' first victory of the season? The Vikings actually adopted some of the keys and won their first game last weekend.
He fell off the wagon, which was unfortunate. Got back on it. Recovered in time to put together four keys. I told him to calm down a little bit. Like, I mean, yeah, the Texans, okay, but they didn't really try. So I told Keys, you got to calm down. And he did. Yeah, but he still put together four for this weekend.
The more I think about that Texans game, too, like in the moment, you're thinking, well, the Vikings, man, this is a pretty good offensive performance here. Yes. Defense with a bunch of backups and rookies is stepping up against Deshaun Watson. And then stories come out about how, yeah, the players decided that Bill O'Brien, they basically had a mutiny the week before in practice or 2 weeks before, whatever it was. And J.J. Watt basically looked at the roster and said, guys, this dude's got to go. Whatever needs to happen the next 2 weeks, this dude's got to go.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the Vikings have a victory, but I don't know how much we really learned about them in that Texans game because the Texans were a corpse, and they were actively looking to get their coach and general manager fired.
Yeah, I would say that they got a win, but to get excited about that lone win is probably premature, and you should probably just wait a little bit and let's see. You know, if you upset the Seahawks, that changes my opinion completely. Until then, don't know.
And you know what? If you're kind of wondering here, you know, the Vikings are in, they're feeling good about their offense and they got things back on the right track. Well, this is the right team to play. That's not a perfect Seahawks team. They definitely have a flawed defense, but this is the right team to play in the right national TV environment on a Sunday night to find out, are you really going to do something to push toward 500 this year? Or are you going to be jockeying for a top 10 draft pick? We'll know a lot
more
on Monday morning.
Here on the show, we do not object to.
That is true.
If the latter is true, we're okay with that.
And so let's get to Judd's keys to a Vikings victory in primetime over the Seattle Seahawks.
Boys, he's back on the big notepad. Keys wrote these back on the big notepad. Congratulations, Keys. You've gone from the small notepad, which has my notes for Code of Silence, to Keys.
Oh, Action Movie Rewind is going to be a gem today.
Oh, yeah.
All right, how many keys are we dealing with?
There's only four. We're dealing with four, which I think we've been dealing with for the last 3 weeks. So,
if they lose like three more games in a row, is he going to reduce down to three keys?
Hell yeah. He'll probably be down to two before you know it at that point in time, which is fine, too. Key number four. Oh, we're not starting off good. Key number four. Seattle slew the secondary? Oh, boy.
Wow.
All right. Fortunately, the headline, while not good, is backed up by some statistics here, which are, and that is the fact that Kirk Cousins leads the NFL in average completed air yards, 9.8 yards. That is 1.8 yards ahead of the second place quarterback. And furthermore, Justin Jefferson, who obviously has been great these last two games, is first in Pro Football Focus's overall grade and ranks for receivers weeks 1 through 4, 90.6. Second on that list, Adam Thielen, 87.6. You are going, the fundamental start of this game, if you are Cousins, is, well, it's twofold. Play action to Dalvin Cook, and then take your shots down the field and hit those shots. And don't be afraid to take them, and be certain about taking them. No hesitation, no padding the football, no staying in the pocket and thinking, oh my God, should I run now because I'm the new Kirk Cousins and I run more. Uh-uh. Drop back to pass, throw the ball. You know what? Worst case, boys, it gets picked. Best case, though, this is a Seattle secondary, and here's the incredible stat, okay? Seattle is 32nd and last in the National Football League, giving up, defensively, 401.
Keys has a little bit of chicken scratch when it comes to
the line. Keys got a little drunk here. 401 yards. No, the stat was correct. 401 yards per game. 32nd in the league. They're giving up 401 passing yards per game. Here's the incredible stat.
That's hilarious.
So Seattle, this is remarkable. Seattle's run defense going into this game is third in the NFL.
Yeah, it's like 3 yards a carry or something.
75.8 yards per game, which is just outstanding, okay? But their pass defense is so legendarily bad right now that they are last in the NFL in total defense because they are giving up an average of 476.8 yards per game.
Did you? Let me throw three more out. I emailed you three. You didn't touch on one of these yet, did you?
No.
The three I emailed you yesterday?
Go ahead. Right. Go ahead.
I'm going to help Keys make his point even more clearly, okay?
This is
amazing stuff.
Remarkable.
So here's more statistical evidence. The Seahawks only get pressure on 20% of opposing quarterback dropbacks, which is bottom 10 in the league, so that's bad, but it gets worse. The Seahawks defense has allowed by far the most air yards on completions, so not like dump off and they can't make a tackle. ball traveling through the air, point A to point B.
Which Cousins is thriving at.
Yes. In four games, they've allowed 1,111 yards just through the air, not counting yards after catch. That's 300 more yards allowed than the next closest bad defense. The Vikings are actually third worst on that list, so they shouldn't be too haughty. The Seahawks have also allowed the third most yards after the catch.
Right.
That all adds up to the 400 yards a game.
So big plays immediately, right?
So this is like this is a Justin Jefferson game. I don't want to like step on any more keys here, but yeah, throw the ball. Right.
Throw the ball early, often, and deep, and don't hesitate. Like, that's what I don't want. The one thing is, Kirk, be decisive. Jefferson, will catch it. Thielen, probably against these guys, will catch it. Throw the ball. Don't pat the ball. Don't act like you're about to cry in the pocket. Deliver the rock down the field. That's key number four. We're only getting started.
Key number three to a Vikings upset over Seattle. 7-point underdogs in this game.
Key number three. Tie up Tyler and DJ. All right. So you've got Hughes is going to come back and play. It looks like after he missed back-to-back games with a neck injury. Gladney will play. Dantzler will play. Holton Hill went from being limited in practice on Wednesday to being out on Thursday. He might not play, and if he doesn't play, he doesn't play. He's not that good. It's okay. But so far through the first 4 weeks, DK Metcalf of Seattle is tied for the most receiving yards in the league through four games. 26 catches, 403 yards, two touchdowns. Tyler Lockett, tie up Tyler, is 14th in the league in receiving yards with 26 catches for 298 yards and four touchdowns. Your main job here is to find out. And you know what? This is a very good progression standpoint. It probably won't be perfect. In fact, it almost certainly will not be. But this is a very good chance to see what the progress of guys like especially Dantzler and Gladney has been. And so if you can even limit these guys a bit, which is going to be imperative, but if you can show that you have grown from, let's say, the Green Bay game, right? Just grown from that. You're not going to eliminate these two guys, but let's just say that you've taken steps. That becomes very important. So limit Metcalf and limit Lockett to a point where, and this is going to be tough, I get that, but where we say, oh, you know what? Those guys look like they're making progress. Not shutdown, just progress.
Yeah. So on Dantzler and Gladney, I think you're trying to walk a line. And by the way, you don't really have a choice. You have to play them this season. So even if things are going poorly, they're a little bit like starting pitchers. Like we've seen some of these Twins teams where it's like, well, or when they haven't had a center fielder or something, it's like, all right, well, Aaron Hicks, I guess you're coming up, buddy, from Double A. We don't have anybody else. There's no one to give these guys a spell if they run into a stretch where it's just like impossible for them to cover someone. So they are being thrown into the pool and they're being told swim. They're not being asked if they can swim. They're being told swim.
Right.
And I think the question's going to be if those guys can't handle it and you're facing Russell Wilson, and I know that the Falcons are bad, but you're facing Matt Ryan, who's won an MVP award, and Aaron Rodgers again. If those guys start to really pick these guys apart, is it going to be something that comes back around to help them a lot and expedites how good they can be earlier because they just got their lesson shoved down their throat early and often? Or is it going to cause irreparable damage to their confidence and to their potential upside? I like to lean toward, hey, just give them all the lessons right now, throw them in the pool, and they'll figure it out. I think that's what's going to happen, but this could be a rough stretch. Russell Wilson, Matt Ryan, Aaron Rodgers in your next three games.
The answer to your question is very, very simple. It is the former if the coaching is wrong. It is the latter if the coaching is constructive. You have, if you are Zim and Spielman and the coaching staff, you have put these two young men in a position to fail if that's what you consider them to be doing. But if it's learning lessons in which you can go back to the tape after every game and be like, okay, yeah, it didn't work. But you know what? That's okay because you progressed here and you didn't here. I really think that the answer to your question comes down to how are those two in particular now coached up? And if the expectation is, gentlemen, this is the National Football League and you have to go out there every Sunday and stop these guys and we are going to treat you like we would a veteran, that's on the coaches and that's a disservice. So I really believe that this all comes back to how do you handle their failures? Because if you handle them right, there's no reason why they can't grow. If you yell and scream and get mad, then it creates some problems. I think this is largely on one guy, and that's Mike Zimmer.
Yeah, patience is going to be the key here. So just for the record, according to Pro Football Focus, there have been 117 cornerbacks who played at least 20% of the team snaps. So 117 cornerbacks that have racked up some playing time. I'm just going to go through here real quick. So keep that number in mind. Out of 117,
hold on, yeah.
Vikings cornerbacks rank Holton Hill is 105 in PFF rating. So he's been the worst.
Okay.
He's been the worst. Mm-hmm. Jeff Gladney and Mike Hughes are 79 and 80. So below average, not great. Cam Dantzler is 59th. So not amazing, but just sort of right in the middle of the pack. I guess you'd call him just an average cornerback, which is I think that's a good sign that early on he's there's definitely been some hiccups for him and he hasn't played every game, but that there's a little bit of a sign that okay, he's not a complete disaster. When I see Drew Samia out there two games as a starter, and it's like whoa, he's
Holton
overwhelmed.
Holton Hill as well. That's exactly right.
Yeah, but Dantzler's shown a couple signs. So he's been their best cornerback, right around average, and then the other three guys who've logged major playing time are all either toward the bottom or between average and the bottom. Key number two to a Vikings win.
Oh, I see what you did here, Keys. This is I like this one. They might not. Let Russ steam. Huh?
Wow.
I thought it was let Russ cook. No. If you're the Vikings, you want him to be steaming. Steaming mad, that is. Here's the key here. When it comes to Russell Wilson, and I'm going to take you guys back to, I believe it was a chilly January day, January 5th, if I'm not mistaken, 2020, before we knew the year was going to go to hell. The Vikings played the Saints in the Superdome in a playoff game, right? And who in that game came up with a scheme where we're all like, oh my God, oh, Mike Zimmer, what are you doing? Danielle Hunter, Everson Griffin are going inside? Drew Brees is a mess! This is incredible! That's more of this. If you want to win this game, you are going to have to get creative as hell, right? Like the back end is going to probably do what the back end does, but the front end you can get creative with and you can try different things. If I am Zimmer, I'm coming up with creative blitz packages and I am getting in Russell Wilson's face and I am, and this is going to sound weird, but it makes some sense. I am coming up with an idea to spy Wilson and hit him on every time he drops back, every time he touches the football. Unless he's on the sideline, I want one guy to be continually pestering him. And if that guy even takes a penalty or two, that's fine. Because the only way to get to the Seahawks offense is to, as one great coach who put a bounty on the head of Brett Favre once said, you have to cut off the head, right? You have to cut off the head. You have to get after Wilson continually. You have to make him mad. You have to frustrate him. It's going to be incredibly difficult. But if you just play your style, he's going to carve you up and annihilate you. Get creative. Make him mad. Make him flustered, which is tough. I get all of those things. It's the only chance that you have, though. And your defense is such a mess right now that this is an attempt where it's a blank canvas, I think, as far as ideas go.
Do you remember, this is a little bit apples to oranges, because I think Russell Wilson is just a much more precise and accurate passer. But in 2016, Cam Newton was coming off an MVP season, a 15-1 run with the Carolina Panthers. They went to the Super Bowl. They got beat. But Cam Newton was like top of the world, mobility, big down the field passer. And the Carolina Panthers came in and played the Minnesota Vikings that season in late September, it was. It was like week 4 or week 5. And Cam Newton was absolutely stymied and confused and bottled up by a Mike Zimmer defense. So he did throw for 262 yards, but he had no touchdowns, 3 interceptions in that game. He was sacked 8 times for 64 yards, and he only ran the ball 7 times for 26 yards. So they and I'd have to go back and like watch the film to see, you know, what was the exact strategy. But if I remember right, I think they put Anthony Barr essentially on Cam Newton.
I think you're right.
And that he just sort of shattered him around. And if he ran, Anthony Barr was there. Or if it wasn't Anthony Barr, then maybe it was a young Eric Kendricks. I think Eric Kendricks was a rookie that season. But But that's kind of the blueprint where he was at the top of his game. Russell Wilson now is a better version or is just a better quarterback than Cam Newton was then. But Mike Zimmer has shown the ability to stymie mobile quarterbacks who can throw down the field.
Yes, and give him looks, give Russ looks that he is not expecting from your team.
Yep. And key number one to a Vikings victory.
It's not going
to
surprise you one bit at all. Key number one is this, make Dalvin dynamic. Dalvin Cook had tied his career high with 27 carries against the Texans, had 29 total touches because he also caught two passes. To go back to what I said, Seattle's rushing defense is good. 75.8 yards per game is third in the league. But the Vikings offensively are averaging 150.5 yards per game, fifth in the league in rushing. And the make Dalvin dynamic part doesn't even mean that he has to get 27 carries on Sunday, because I do think that the Vikings' main threat is going to be in the passing game with Jefferson and Thielen and Eureka, boys, perhaps the tight ends too. But Dalvin Cook has to be on the field all of the time, and play action has to be a continual perceived threat all the time. Because if you stop Seattle and they think, oh, he's going to run again, they're going to freeze, right? They're already suspect in the back end. So Dalvin Cook has to play basically not every snap, but he's got to be the perceived threat continually. And in a key place in this game, Madison might be fine eventually, and I like him. This is not saying he's not a good player. But Kubs, closed circuit to Kubs, in a key series in this game, you need the perception that Dalvin Cook is going to carry the ball, and the only way to create that is to have him on the field.
So if the Seahawks defense continues to follow the same pattern that it's followed for the first month of the season, this is a Dalvin Cook decoy game for me. Like, this is Dalvin Cook.
But he's always on the field.
The threat of Dalvin Cook to set up the guys who should be the ones putting up big numbers this week, again, per what the Seahawks defense has shown the first month. This is a Kirk Cousins, Justin Jefferson, Adam Thielen game set up by Dalvin Cook.
Correct.
And I don't think you can just not use Dalvin Cook and still get the productivity out of the two wide receivers and Kirk Cousins. But according to, here's another stat for you, Keys. All right. According to fantasypros.com, and I get that fantasy football, a little bit different than real world football, but this kind of tells you which defenses are weak against which position groups. The Seattle Seahawks have allowed by far the most wide receiver points in fantasy football this season, and the second most quarterback points. Quarterbacks and wide receivers in particular are lighting up. Like that Packers game the other night on, what was it, Sunday Night Football? When did the Packers last play? Whatever it was.
Monday night against Atlanta.
And Aaron Rodgers was without his two wide receivers. Aaron Rodgers went 20 for 20 just targeting running backs and tight ends for like 250 yards. And so like the Falcons are a disaster against other position groups. The Seahawks have been respectable against tight ends and more than respectable against running backs, and they've let wide receivers run all over the field. So use Dalvin Cook to open up the other guys.
But he's going to have to play continually and pass protect, which he is very good at picking up blitzes and things like that. So this is a game that Dalvin Cook needs to play a ton. He just doesn't have to carry it as much. But this is a game where no matter what people might say, the play action can definitely work. Here's a stat that's incredible. So to go back to the Seahawks passing stat, 401 yards per game given up, 32nd and last in the league, okay? The Vikings are 29th, so they're not good. So they're right by, they are basically the neighbor of the Seahawks in the statistical category. They're giving up 291.8 passing yards per game. So again, they're right by Seattle, 291.8. Seattle's at 401. Like, think about the discrepancy in that stat and how far the Vikings are down to how bad Seattle is in trying to stop the pass.
The saving grace for the Seahawks defense, they do have 6 interceptions this season. So they've at least been able to, all right, the yardage wave is coming at them, and then they're able to just, like, whether it's jumping a route or I haven't looked at all 6 interceptions, but
let Russ steam, though, huh?
I like where you're going.
Let Russ steam, Declan. Little applause for that.
It's all right. Yeah. It's okay.
It's all right.
Keys is feeling himself after a Vikings win last week.
What did him and Stella get into last night there, Judd?
A little pumpkin spice something?
Little pumpkin patch?
No comment. I was watching baseball and football.
A little cider?
I was watching TB12. He thought there were five downs, I guess.
I picked up a little apple cider yesterday at the grocery store, a little whiskey apple cider over rocks.
You're
not bad. What do you mean not?
You're unbelievable.
I had two, and I was in bed at 11 o'clock. It was great.
Certix should send you a thank you. How do they not endorse you?
I actually racked up so many points over the last year. The other day, it took off 50% of my bill. She was like, you have like $25 in rewards.
She's
for
like,
us.
You own 5% of the store now.
She was
great.
She was just like, do you want to use those? I was like, absolutely, I want to use those. So,
some people would call it a problem. I call it a very impressive
solution.
Factoid about Declan.
I'm 1 week into Sober October for the first time.
I've never done.
So some people do like
January.
No drink January or whatever.
Yeah.
Or no booze, whatever.
Or
so
February,
Sober October.
One of those,
I have a lot of people who are on this kick.
It's very
weekend.
Common.
Yeah,
it's been. I feel like I've slept a little bit better.
That's
now.
Good.
Now we have found a couple non-alcoholic beverages. Mm-hmm. So I went and got some non-alcoholic IPAs yesterday.
Mm. How are they?
Non-alcoholic IPAs.
Yeah, I mean it's hard enough. To
I'm
going to
go
one.
Flush my cash down the toilet now. Don't mind me.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
Non-alcoholic. Why don't you just bail on the whole thing? All or nothing.
I'm excited for Bender November is what I'm really looking forward to. All right. Those are Judd's keys to a
Vikings keys.
Victory.
I've bailed out. I take no blame for this.
Boys, Action Movie Rewind takes us to our first Chuck Norris flick.
One day, I would like to give you a gift of a Colombian necktie. Very special. You slit the throat. Pull out the tongue, and I knew it would look beautiful.
Why don't you give it to me right now? See you guys later.
Yeah, okay, Eddie.
Well, look what's here. Nice to see you out with the boys for a change, Cusack.
Reggie?
They tell me my sergeant wouldn't sign for me. Want to tell me why?
You know why.
No, tell me.
Mister, you don't belong on the streets anymore.
You. Where do you get off?
Right about here.
Action Movie Reviews with Mackie, Judd, and Rami.
Get to the chopper!
Yippee-ki-yay, mother...
I don't know. I was in there watching films with my girl. The next thing I know, he locked the door. He took the truck, went out the south end. I don't know what happened.
Okay, what the hell's going on here?
Cusack took off with a whole truckload of armor.
Some one-man army now.
What did I tell you? The son of a bitch is crazy.
Okay, everybody, no more games. Where's Cusack?
He's saving the world.
Welcome in to Action Movie Rewind, episode 28, here on the Mackie and Judd Show. Code of Silence, 1985, our first Chuck Norris flick. Gentlemen, we've done Steven Seagal movies, we've done Sylvester Stallone movies, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Bruce Willis. You name it, we've pretty much done.
We've run the gamut now.
Eddie Murphy, Mel Gibson. But there's one legend of action that we have yet to dive into here. And I feel like he's a little bit of an afterthought when it comes to action movies, even though that's how he built his legacy. Because he's become more of a meme in modern culture. And he looks the same at age like 80 as he did when he was 40. Google a picture of Chuck Norris. He literally has like
80. He's 80.
Dyed red beard and red hair.
Uh-huh.
Pretty amazing.
Okay.
So, Code of Silence from 1985. We're going to do a deep dive.
Okay, home team, ready in a bullpen.
Come to shortstop. Double play.
We got the meth.
Center's in.
Where's Craigie? Talk to me, left field.
Damn it.
Ready, sir. Left field is in position.
Okay, guys. Run around first base.
Double play. You got him in sight?
Yeah, we got the eyes on him. Head for the alley.
Is that how real undercover cops talk to each other, by the way?
To baseball fans,
baseball
for sure.
Analogies.
Yeah.
Okay. Double switch. Yeah. Shift over at the left-handed
never
batter.
Never bunt. Never ever bunt. Never not bunt. Now. We've learned that in law enforcement. You don't bunt.
We got a lock.
Strikeout swinging on three pitches. Miguel, strikeout swinging on three pitches. High fastball. All right. Here's the summary, and then we'll dive into all of the different things. In Chicago.
Chicago.
Honor-driven sergeant Eddie Cusack. That's Chuck Norris. And his team stake out a drug exchange involving notorious drug czar Luis Camacho. Cusack is caught off guard, however, when rival mafia kingpin Tony Luna and his disguised crew show up, unleash a torrent of gunfire on Camacho's crew, and make off with both the cash and the cocaine. Now Cusack must fight both gangs and corruption in his own department in order to stop the drug war. Chuck Norris, Dennis Farina making his first ever appearance of many as a cop in a movie in this one. I've got a note on that for you guys.
A real Chicago cop?
He was. At the time of this movie, he was a real Chicago cop.
Great, great hair.
Also, we had the Tommy Gun guy from Home Alone playing Craggy. You guys remember? Yeah.
Oh, is that who that was?
In the black and white movie?
Yeah.
I'm going to give you to the count of 10 to get your dead,
ugly,
no good,
yellow
carcass off of my property. Oh. 1, 2, 10. And he shoots him.
I've got a lot of thoughts on Craggy, by the way.
Craggy's a...
When we get to Craggy, when we get to Craggy, that's a breakdown.
Also, did you notice Milton from Office Space played one of the cops in this movie? You guys Office Space fans?
Oh, I love Office Space.
That's why I knew the voice.
It wasn't, you couldn't really tell by his voice as much. It was more just like he looked still exactly, 13 years earlier, he looked like Milton from Office Space. Mustache.
And Milton was in News Radio, correct?
I think that's true.
He was the boss in that show. He's great. He's a great actor.
And,
he's hilarious.
Brennan, the officer, Rob Dean, the actor, he's Andrew's dad in Breakfast Club that drops him off and reams him for messing around.
That's right.
Look at all the time.
Oh, my God. There's more, too. Like, there's probably 5 more of these that we could do.
Yeah.
So just a lot of fun little side characters. 63% on Rotten Tomatoes. A $7 million budget turned into $20 million at the box office. Judd, what was your key takeaway from this particular movie, Code of Silence?
I have so many thoughts and just because I've never seen this and I loved it. It's such a Judd film. My first thought is, dare I say this? This is the type of film that my guy Seagal completely ruins in a good way. And Chuck Norris actually doesn't. Like, if that makes any sense, and I know it's campy,
I hear you.
And I know it's a cop film, but like this was, the script was basically the exact same between what Seagal did in his cop films at times and this film. But because Chuck Norris, I guess the best way to say this is can sort of act and Seagal can't.
Not particularly well, but Seagal can act, and that's what I love about
I love Seagal because he just flat out can't act and he doesn't know it.
Yeah.
And Chuck Norris can act a little bit, that I felt like I was watching a Seagal script that basically got shoveled off to Chuck. But that's my first thought, is that this was, I thought it was running time perfect. I thought the character development, if not hilarious, was actually pretty good. I enjoyed it. This is a film I never would have watched to my dying day unless it was part of this, in part of our reviews. And because I did, I'm better for it.
Declan, what was your main takeaway from this movie?
There's a lot. I love all the undercover cops. I would honestly say that's my favorite part.
You had undercover cops and undercover mafia members. Yeah. Like, everyone's just undercover as a painter.
Yeah, everyone's undercover the whole movie.
Why are those painters there?
And I also, this didn't really happen until the pool scene where he's at the pool bar.
That's a great...
But the sound effects of every punch and kick.
Here.
Who wants the first one? Hmm? You, amigo? How about you, huh?
The gun, cabrón.
Listen to these.
Take him apart.
Like, usually I omit that stuff from the sound effects that I, or sound bites that I pull from movies, but it was so unique I had to pull it. Like, you hear clear as day him, he kicks a guy below the groin, and you just hear a nut, like it snaps, and you hear bones snap, and you hear everything snap. I was shocked for like, what, this is 1985, I believe?
86, yeah.
86, so.
Or something, yeah. Maybe, whatever.
They were right on brand with the sound effects. I thought that
surround
was also
sound,
hilarious.
Man.
Yeah, surround sound.
Surround sound, back in the day.
My main takeaway from this movie is that it was just wildly entertaining, and Chuck Norris, I've only seen one Chuck Norris movie straight through, and it was 1993 Sidekicks. It's kind of a kid's movie. It's like a kid.
I've never seen one before.
A kid. It was probably Chuck Norris's most, I would say, like mainstream successful movie because it blended in with like it was right into his Walker Texas Ranger debut in the early 90s. But I've never seen like a vintage classic Chuck Norris action movie straight through before. And I just made a full list of like all the amazing things that happened. I just want to kind of go through this because my main takeaway was I want to watch more Chuck Norris movies. That's my main takeaway. So early on, there's the scene where he goes to the art gallery to find Diana Luna, right? And so he walks over. He sees Diana Luna talking to that nerdy art guy and then some other woman. And he walks over and he asks, excuse me, can you tell me who that girl is? Which is a weird thing to do. Like in, yes. 2020, that doesn't hold up. You would never just like walk up to strangers and say, hey, who's your friend? I think I know her.
Yeah, because right.
They'd be like, call the cops. Yeah. You're a creep, you're right? A creeper.
And then he'd say, I am the cops.
But he goes,
I'm going to kick your ass.
He asks, can you tell me who that girl is? The one in the black slacks? She was wearing, if you remember, like a bright red puffy pirate shirt and black slacks. And he walks up to this group and asks, hey, do you know who that girl was? And then he's like, I'm going to describe her for you. She was wearing black pants and no mention of like the red puffy like pirate shirt. So just like, I don't know if that was an ad lib or if it was like part of the script. Then he catches the artist doing coke in the back and gets great. On the phone and loudly shows that he's a cop and then says, catch you later as he catch walks back out. That was pretty good. When he walks onto, was it Scalise, I think, the guy's boat, the uncle of Tony Luna. He walks on the guy's boat and tells him to rein in his nephew, Tony Luna. Then he punches, as he's walking out, he punches that one guy off the boat and does the callback line of, it's not a threat. It's a prediction. Like, he has these little Seagal
lines. Eddie Cusack. Yeah. They tell me you're incorruptible, untarnished. I hear they call you stainless steel on the street. Me, I think you're a pain in the ass.
Looking for one of your nephews, Tony Luna.
Goodbye, Mr. Cusack.
Nobody talks, right?
That's right, Sergeant. Just like the cops. Just like the Camachos. Nobody talks. Omerta.
I'm going to find Tony Luna, and I'm going to nail his ass. Anyone else connected to him? You got that?
Why, you punk.
Nobody threatens me.
It's not a threat, Mr. Scalise.
No!
It's a prediction.
Oh, it's so good.
Because he had thrown that guy in before he got on the boat, and then he punched him back as he was trying to get back on the boat.
You also had the scene where he dives off the bridge in downtown Chicago into the river to chase that guy. Of course, when he gets in the water, the other guy looks up and gets hit by a speedboat, and so he's dead. And then Chuck Norris swims over to a nearby police boat. You know, this is downtown Chicago, for God's sake. They're showing people like looking over the bridges.
Yeah.
So he gets out of the boat, soaking wet, does not dry himself off, and immediately makes eye contact with Diana Luna from like 150 or 200 yards away on the bridge and walks over slowly, again, soaking and dripping wet, downtown Chicago, having just gotten out of the river, and sits down and says, like, I'll protect you. We'll go to the safe house with my random weird friend who makes scrambled eggs for breakfast and sausage for you.
Who, of course, is going to have to die because we have to kill all the people around me who I like.
Yes. So I don't know. I guess, you know, but my long-winded way of saying is, like, I think Chuck Norris is great at this. And I think a lot of people are probably like, yeah, idiot. Like, we've known that for 40 years. What did you guys make of Chuck Norris as an action movie star?
I loved how the hair never moved. He's got that great puffy 80s head of hair.
Yeah.
And it never moves. He gets beat up. It doesn't move. He gets hit in the back by a pool cue ball. It doesn't move. Here's the most interesting thing to me, and it's true of Seagal films. It's true of this film. And it's basically true of all of those cop films across the board. If you were going to write one of those films, you had a blueprint that you started with. It's very, very clear, clear as day. And it includes this. The main character, while everyone else will be shot around him, the main character and the heroine will never be shot. They will be threatened. They will be tortured. And I would have killed his cop buddy in a second. But for Chuck's character, I can have him six ways to Sunday. He's dead, right? I've got him. I've got him, and I can kill him, but I won't. The other thing that I absolutely love, too, is the old, and it's true at the end of every Seagal film, and it's true at the end of this film. You basically create mass destruction, right? You blow up everything. You cost your city thousands, millions of dollars in damage. You're blowing up warehouses or you're shooting up streets. You are without any thought, basically going to get the bad guys. And you might kill 20 people. But the boss asks you the question, you coming to work tomorrow? And you always say, you pause. You look at the camera a little bit and you're like, I'll see it then.
Well, notice, he wasn't just looking at the camera. He was looking at the other cops to see, because those cops had disowned him.
I know.
Because he ratted out Craigie.
Well, Craigie's
another. And so he looks at the other cops and they all give the slight nod, like, we know that you were right about Craigie. We know that guy. And we'll get to the Craigie part, but they give him the nod and then he gives the
But don't you love the thumbs up. Like, there would be so much paperwork to have to put, turn in.
Oh, there
you
was. Just that's cre- the, that's the just, sequel, the paperwork
you
cleanup.
You just killed all of these people. You just basically, and you demolished all of this stuff. You took, in this film, you took probably $1 million police robot that they were working on and used it for your own gain.
I love how Jeb brings up the paperwork. Would you watch the sequel, Code of Silence, Administration Monday? Administration. The paperwork cleanup.
I just like how there's never any, like, repercussions of, yeah, you just killed 25 people. Nah, it's okay.
Whatever. All right, let's go to a pub, boys. Let's tip a couple back. This will be amazing.
You coming to work tomorrow? Yeah.
By the way, this is the end sequence.
Hey, Eddie. Hey, Kurt. I got a great idea. Mail order Christmas trees. Well, think about it.
See you tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yes, and he gives the nod. Not great as an audio, but he gives the nod on the music.
The music's great, though.
Yeah, I had to keep it in there.
So my when I was a kid on the Chuck Norris front, I used to watch my family and I every single, I think it was Friday nights, maybe it was Saturday nights, Walker, Texas Ranger. Was one of the most popular shows in the 90s. I think if you're making like a Mount Rushmore of 90s TV shows and you take out sitcoms, so if you take out like, I think there's sitcom Mount Rushmore, and then there's the drama and action Mount Rushmore TV shows. ER's on it.
Oh, yeah.
I think Walker, Texas Ranger is on that list. It was very highly rated from like, it,
CBS?
It was an 8-year run.
Yeah. It's CBS?
CBS.
Yep. Okay. And I think it wasn't just like, it was like after Letterman on Friday nights or something. So it had a great lead in. So you never watched Walker, Texas Ranger?
Never watched one of them.
Every single episode, I'm assuming Declan, you were probably too young to watch the show.
No, but I always saw it on the guide and stuff too, just like exact same time spots you're saying.
So every episode was an hour, and every episode followed the same timeline. I think they may have had some like cliffhanger part one, part twos, but every episode was something happens to Chuck Norris or friends or something happens. He has to go through some adversity in the middle part of it. And then at the end, it's just him, usually without a weapon, kicking ass for like the last 10 minutes of the show.
And never being shot.
Yeah.
Because we can't shoot him. Nope. We've shot everybody else.
Nope. We got to get 8 seasons out of this.
No bullets left.
The other thing I remember from that era, and this is probably before Declan too, but Judd, you have to remember the Total Gym infomercials with Chuck Norris and Christie Brinkley.
Oh, very much so. Yeah.
All the time.
Good looking people.
Very good looking people.
Very good looking people.
I would say Christie Brinkley better looking in her realm than Chuck Norris was.
Oh, sure. But Chuck's a build guy. A
couple of very fit people.
Yes.
And it was just
kick
like,
your ass.
People thought they were like together and married, but apparently they weren't.
She was with Billy Joel at one point in the 80s, I think it was.
Yeah.
And then they got divorced.
And she's been married a few times.
Yeah.
But it was basically like them for an hour just like spotting each other on the Total Gym.
Actually, the first swimsuit issue that turned up in young Judd Zolgad's mailbox circa 79 or 80.
Oh, my God.
Christie Brinkley on the cover. Let me tell you, that was a highlight. I'm serious. It's like the first one, the first SI, and this is back when it was just part of the weekly SI. It's like, hey, it's Jim Palmer 1 week, Wayne Gretzky the next, and here's a half-naked Christie Brinkley for you.
Hey, it's 66.
Amazing, man.
Still looks pretty good.
Oh, yeah, she's honestly, she was supposed to be on Dancing with the Stars a year or two, but then she like broke her arm and her daughter took over, but then she was in the crowd every, and it's like she looks the same as she did 25 years ago.
Remarkable. Yes.
That's great.
It's amazing what millions of dollars in surgeries can do. Mm. All right. This is my fault. We've kind of deviated from some of the categories that we've done through the early portion of Action Movie Rewind. So I want to get back to those and ask your favorite part of Code of Silence. Judd.
It has to be, I'm going to go off the map here a little bit. Mm-hmm. It has to be the scenes with Craigie.
Okay.
Who might be the best, most cliched corrupt cop of all time without, like, this guy, the Craigie guy.
The actor. The guy from the black and white movie in Home Alone.
Okay. Like, I think he got the script and he's like, I'm getting older. This role, okay, I'll take it. And, like, all the lines were cliched. What are you talking about? Huh? You're not going to turn on me now, are you?
Yeah, like the machismo.
Yes, but it's like and
fuck it, you're not gonna turn on me now, huh?
Like, here's the other thing. So when he shoots the defenseless, innocent, completely kid, okay?
Yeah, let's set that up.
Can we talk about that scene?
It's possible some people
super messed up.
Okay, so he comes upstairs.
I would hope that some people, like, when you know what movie we're gonna watch it with us. It makes these more fun.
Yeah,
but yeah, they're chasing
the guys who were posing as painters.
Yep.
And they're like canvassing, and Craigie and his partner, the very cliched young partner, I'm green. I don't know what to do here. They come up the stairs. Craigie comes up the stairs first. There is a kid standing outside his grandma's door.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's the part that I actually, it's my favorite part. The kid is standing there by himself. He basically pivots around to be like, what's going on here? Craigie, without any thought,
no judgment.
Blows him away. Just blows him away. Okay, but it gets better. It gets better.
Oh, my God. What did I do?
Young partner, who's green and doesn't know what to do, comes up. Is like, what happened here? The guy pulled a gun. Because Craigie's got the cliche police drop piece in his sock, which is great, too. He puts it on the kid. Now, here's the part I want to get to talk to you guys about. Because to me, it's where the film had a budget and they're like, oh, Christ, let's not pay more people. Mm-hmm. It's this. The kid's grandma and whoever is in the apartment are making a ton of noise and are clearly trying to articulate to the crowd, the audience watching the film, that they know that Junior has been shot, okay? But they never come out.
We never
see them. All we hear is this canned, oh no, oh, it can't be.
Think about that.
It's all canned. It's like literally, they probably just bought that sound from somewhere and played it.
Like, I hadn't thought about that angle, but It's a close quarters apartment complex hallway.
Yeah.
There's multiple family members clearly just inside the door because, like, the kid opened the door and there's, like, a ruckus and stuff, right?
Yes.
He gets shot. So there's a gunshot in the hallway. No one thinks to peek out the door.
No.
The kid is dead. No one thinks to peek out the door.
No one ever comes out.
And the cop plants a gun on the kid. And no one from that kid's family, like, shows up at the hearing or anything to say.
But they didn't see it because they didn't exist. They were canned sound. It was canned sound. But the whole thing, the whole scene goes down with this poor, 14, 15-year-old kid.
Yeah.
And nobody ever comes out. Like, how did they dispose of the body?
And, like, I feel like there's a whole nother movie if they wanted to, and I would watch it totally. If they would have done it like as a sequel and it was just called Craigie and it was Craigie's life, 30 years as a Chicago police officer. How did he get to be such a bad apple?
You don't belong on the streets.
So
Craigie.
Grizzled.
Craigie.
What led Craigie to that moment? And then the trial.
Although Craigie's partner, who then gets assigned to Cusack, is also so cliched. It's beautiful.
He's troubled. He's drinking beer to cover up his emotional wreckage. Yeah.
So
baggage.
Anyway, but the Craigie stuff to me was just marvelous.
It's amazing. It's awesome.
Dex, what was your favorite part of this movie?
So we kind of briefly touched on it, but it's when Chuck Norris is stalking the daughter like throughout the entire day at the park, and then at the library, and then he's at the art show, and I'm thinking to myself like, man, like he looks like a pretty legitimate undercover dude. Like he doesn't even look like he's a cop. I wrote down he had like a tweed jacket on.
Yes.
Right, like a turtleneck. He's in an art club. I'm like, man, this dude fits right in. Like good on Chuck Norris here. And then Chuck Norris walks up to her, and within 3 seconds, she knows he's a cop. So I like it was a self error on my part, being like, "Man, this is really good. Like he's blending in. He like I would imagine this dude being at an art show.
Yeah, they're standing next to the same painting, and he goes, can you make that
do
out or whatever?
Do you understand it?'" Yeah. And then she within 3 seconds, "You're a cop, dude." Like, and I'm just like, "Well, I'm an idiot." Because so like it was self error, but also it fits so well because like you also don't know, and this is one of my nitpicks too, but like. Is she 17? Is she 25? Like, how old is the daughter?
That's very true.
Okay.
We never really touch on that.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And let's save that for a second because that's actually part of my least favorite thing about the movie.
For sure.
So off of Dex point too, and these were huge at that time, and they were the most uncomfortable. I couldn't stand them. The sweater that he wears throughout that film, I hated those things.
The turtleneck
sort of, but it's not a turtleneck. It's sort of a turtleneck, but it's sort of, I think some of them are lower cut. Anyway, in the 80s, these things were huge and they were, as far as I was concerned, uncomfortable. They didn't look good. Like I hated them. And I think he's sporting one throughout the whole film.
He is. He's going to be very sweaty underneath that thing.
Yeah, that's what I kept thinking is like for all the karate stuff.
In Chicago though. So
is that comfortable though? Like he's got tight jeans on. And like a fitted sweater.
I mean, every single episode of Walker, Texas Ranger, he had like tight Wranglers, boots, and spurs on, and like like a leather jacket, and a hat that stayed on too. He had like the Ranger hat that never fell off his head. It's amazing. My favorite thing about this movie, other than just like Chuck Norris being Chuck Norris, I think my favorite part about this movie was when those two dudes walk into that bar full of cops and try and rob the bar. So it's this dive bar with the old style sign out, right? And and you've got the two nervous robbers out in this car.
Clearly
across
a cop
the street.
Bar too. Like it's the most clear cop bar ever.
Yes. Yeah. And if they had done any scouting at all whatsoever, they would have realized it's a cop bar. So they walk in, they've got this plan, like you go to the bathroom and then I'll go up and I'll just, like they were talking and strategizing, I'll order something at the bar, and then you come back, and then we'll do our thing. And the guy goes, "What are you going to order?" He goes, "What does it matter for? Like, I'm not going to drink it." And that stuck in my head because when he goes in and he orders a drink, instead of just ordering like an old style or something, he orders a Black Russian and a shot. He orders like
maybe he changed his mind.
I don't know, but like he wasn't going to drink them, so why would you order two things in that spot if you're not going to? It doesn't make sense. And then why would you rob a bar? Period.
Like, well, wouldn't you have scouted? Oh, it's a cop bar. Maybe we shouldn't rob that one.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, but even if like it's not a cop bar, you've got a couple of guns, you're looking to rob something.
Yeah.
Aren't there places you could rob where there's not going to be like 30 people inside? Couldn't you like
that
go
scene,
rob a jewelry store?
That,
go rob
that scene was literally like they stopped and said, "The film's too short. Let's have some comic relief."
Right.
Yes. 'Cause like it's just a comedy.
Yeah, it was. And then there's the line when the 30 cops all pull their gun at the same time, which is a great scene. And then they've got these two guys in a booth and they're pointing guns at them in the booth and stuff. They're not detaining them or anything. They're just like they're just drunk and messing with these two guys.
Well,
and the one guy goes, "What are you, John Wayne?" This is Milton. I think it was Milton from Office Space with the retort. "I'll make you Jane Wayne if you don't shut up." And he points the shotgun at the guy's. You know what?
Jane
so
Wayne.
Yes. I think because like that scene, the reason why I say that scene is because I think it just like encapsulates the entire vibe of corny 80s kind of grimy dive bar machismo action movies.
Yes.
Like everything about it. There's like 40 people drawing guns. It's machismo. It's a dive bar. It's Roadhouse. It's everything.
One thing that I really did like sincerely about this film, a great use of Chicago.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Like they did a great job with backdrops, scenes and stuff. They did a fantastic job of taking this of giving you the feeling of the city itself.
In fact, where does this movie rank among great downtown Chicago movies?
Ooh. Blues Brothers.
Wow. And
Blues
I say great in quotes. Yeah, Blues Brothers, great The Fugitive.
Movie. Yeah, it's true. Fugitive. Is this better than The Fugitive as far as use of scenes of the city?
I was going to say, there's nothing about this movie that's better than The Fugitive.
No. I'm saying the actual shooting.
They dyed the
Chicago
river green for, or at least they.
But I'm just saying,
on St. Patrick's
like,
Day.
They do a lot of. This film was actually good at taking the city seriously, as opposed to like Seagal films, where it's just like, I'm in Brooklyn. Oh, yeah. Okay. That's the same bodega for the eighth time. Yeah.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off might be in this Mount Rushmore.
Correct.
Probably a bunch of other ones too that we're forgetting, but yeah, it's definitely on the list. They did a great job showcasing downtown Chicago.
Oh, and here another thing. In fact, for cop films, we should do this from now on. We should have the list of things that have to happen for it to be an official cop film.
I'm here for it
because Cusack has the line near the beginning, which every great cop film has. I don't need a partner. Where the sergeant always tries to be like, your partner got shot, and so, Eddie, I'm going to give you the kid. I work alone. I always work alone. That's another staple.
I feel like he was hard on Dennis Farina. Dennis Farina's out here throwing business ideas at him. Let's open a hot dog stand. An alligator farm.
Business idea at him every time.
And he just
hot dog stand
him,
outside the Cubs games at Wrigley Field.
We get free tickets to go inside. Well, how would we watch the games if we're selling hot dogs outside? But I guess I never thought of that. No. guess I never thought of that.
His
before.
Character is supposed to be just basically comic relief the whole time.
Yeah.
Farina's character is supposed to be just this, which is hilarious because he's great, but like he went on to all of these really good films and shows. And in that one, it's like, just play a goofball.
But he also just plays Dennis Farina in every movie that he was ever in. Right, he's just a slightly different
version. Yeah, but I feel like the writing and the
Freeman.
Roles got really pretty decent for him, and this was just like, just keep suggesting off-the-wall stupid things.
Yeah, and he was, as we mentioned earlier, he was an actual Chicago police officer during the making of this film, moonlighting before he became a full-time actor when cast in the leading role, eventually the next year, of the television series Crime Story. What was your least favorite part about this movie, Judd?
That's difficult because I really enjoyed the entire thing.
I have a major one.
Go ahead.
Okay. Because Declan kind of alluded to it.
Sure.
I couldn't tell what Eddie and Diana were supposed to be.
Yeah, dude.
Like
it was freaky. I have it written down too.
I'm trying to describe the vibe. Like the chemistry between them was it was like a house cat and an old man or something. Like it was. There's that one scene where her entire family was just killed.
Yeah.
And she's on the run from the Camachos. And he has taken her to his good friend's house, the small little house where he's just slinging scrambled eggs and like.
Got your protein?
Yeah,
he's a protein. He's a former cop, man. He's a former cop.
And so they're sitting on the bed next to each other, Chuck Norris and Diana. And she's like, reading on Wikipedia, this was her first ever like actual acting gig. Like,
she's from here.
Is she?
Oh,
she
funny.
Was born
One
here.
Wow.
Minneapolis, yes.
Nice.
And she's kind of like trying to force a cry, and she's saying, what do you do if you don't have someone? And Chuck Norris looks at her and goes, you find someone. And it looks like, are they going to like make out here? This is weird. And she goes, will you hold me?
Yeah.
And then he hugs her. And it just kind of feels like, is Chuck Norris taking advantage of her entire family getting killed to like move in and try and build a relationship right now?
Yeah.
And then later on toward the end of the movie, he carries her out of the wreckage of the warehouse. And, you know, she's been like tied up for however many days, and he brings her to the ambulance and puts her on the stretcher. And she's kind of looking at him like, oh, he's my knight in shining armor.
You don't know her age.
And he kisses her on the forehead, and you're like, wait a second. I thought they were like going to get together earlier in the movie, but now is she 14? I don't even know.
But Dex is right. They never give you, like, is she 21? Is
and
she 25?
Even
is she
like she's, like,
15?
Being held captive, like, her entire shirt's, like, unbuttoned.
Yeah.
So it's just like, all right, so I don't think it's a teenager. Like, I think it's an adult woman, but
It's really freaky.
I think she was in college. I think she was college age. Like she's an art, I think, like art student who's
but
at the
Chuck
Chicago
is like 45
Art Gallery.
Then, right?
Yes. How old was he actually in real life? Probably 40. Like, 40 something.
45, I think.
I don't know. Well, I mean, Mike Zimmer's got an Instagram this model.
Is, you know what? This very good point.
So.
I'll back off now.
Mike Zimmer's
very
like
good
65.
So I've
Instagram
got,
gal.
So I've got two. One is Diane, right?
Diana.
Her whole family gets killed. The longtime, I don't know, protector, mafioso protector of the family comes to get her and says, your mom's dead. The family's dead. And then they go on the run, and then the protector guy gets killed, okay? So then at the end of the next chase, Cusack and Diana are together, and she says, is it true? Like, she doesn't even know this guy. And a longtime family friend who basically is paid to protect the family, who has, by the way, failed miserably, has told her your family's dead, and she's asking him, is it true? The other thing, and this is...
She didn't seem nearly as distraught as she should have been.
No.
Knowing that her entire family was killed.
Well, and correct. Like, and then she forced the cry then, but it was like... But, I mean, once the guy says, your family's dead, it'd be like, okay, thank you very much. The other thing, and this is a bigger picture view of... It's not really a complaint, but I found it to be murky. At times, the commitment to violence, I questioned on both sides. Like, there was some of the violence which was pretty sellable, and I thought, okay, yeah, that's good. And then there were times where it appeared that they took the easier way out on the violence. Like, the whole scene with the painters, right?
Yeah.
Like, I thought we could have had more there. And then there's a long span without anything. And then when the guys in the truck kill her family... It's really lazy. It's a really lazy kill. Like the mom comes out. How are the tomatoes? The tomatoes look good.
She says, oh, look at these eggplants. And then.
But they just fall down. They're not even like bleeding.
Imagine.
They don't sell.
How you die is look at these eggplants. And there's a half dozen gunmen in a truck.
But Dex, didn't you want more?
Your final word is eggplant.
Eggplant.
But didn't you want more, Declan? At that point, I'm like, if you're going to kill him, kill him. And then the ultimate in lazy is they go and kill the rest of the family in the house. And all you hear is, again, the canned gun sound.
Right.
So you wanted, like, actual, like, intestines flying out of someone's body, getting sawed in half by a shotgun or something.
If you're admiring eggplants and you get blown away, I want to see you. She's just sort of like, it's just like, fall down now. She just sort of falls down. It's like, no, you just got blown away.
That's fair.
As Declan said, too, he's right, a machine gun. Yeah. Like, your body would be blowing up.
Dex, what was your least favorite part of this movie?
Okay, I feel like you guys might have a nitpick with it, but the whole train chase scene, like, not the chase scene itself, because I like that, but when they're on top of the train.
That's a good one.
And because I think you can tell, like, I think that was a real stunt. Like, it looked pretty real. Like, because you can both tell they're both, like, balancing. Like, it doesn't seem natural.
Yeah.
So he's trying to like apprehend him, but he's also on top of a moving train, and you can tell that both actors are really clunky and like they're trying to punch each other. But then again, you're on like a 60 mile an hour moving train. So I thought that scene was pretty clunky and a little bit off the whole eggplant scene. I was like, man, that's just an awful way to go out, being like eggplants, boom, gone. I thought those were a couple nitpicks that I had.
Then we find out
that's legit.
The title like of the movie, that. The Code of Silence, was another one. Just in terms, like, my least favorite thing in terms of just like, is this a real thing? Code of Silence. So if you're on the cop beat,
I kind of like that though.
And like your partner murders a teenager, implants a gun, and you see it, that you're supposed to just swallow that and live with it the rest of your life, or you break the Code of Silence.
And how is a tough guy like that still known as Craigie?
You don't think Craigie's a tough guy name?
No. Craigie's not a real tough guy name to me. Like, I mean, this guy's a grizzled veteran, dirty cop, and he's Craigie.
He's Craigie.
Craigie.
Hey, Craigie. Me and Craigs are going to go down to the bar, get a couple of brews.
Is he from Boston now? But Craigie. I just don't like Craigie that much. But anyway,
He's got smart pock, guys. I'm going to the bar.
Code of Silence. Code of Silence on smart pock.
Pock my car by the harbor. With my smart pack.
Okay, Can we please talk about the
Pat that keeps calling?
He's called twice, yeah.
Does he want to come on?
He did his thing with Soosh. He said he was going till 10:50. I told him on our production meeting that 11:15 is when we would probably call, 11 and 11:15. We'll see if he calls back. But
was he calling there for the second time to ask if we're ready?
Maybe.
Did you even ask?
I actually picked up the phone and nothing happened. It might have been a butt dial.
I got more here.
Ready? Do you need me?
No. Well, there's way more.
I'm not done yet.
Yeah,
I'm not
done.
I'm not done yet. We need to now get into. I brought it up briefly, but it's worth an entire discussion. The 1986 police robot that the Chicago Police Department had purchased.
Yeah, Judd, it's called the Police Prowler.
I've got it in my notes. The Police Prowler, which by the way was clearly the future, was being unveiled before our eyes, and somewhere Cusack gets his hands on this thing and turns it into a prolific killing machine.
How do you feel
can we please discuss
the Chicago Police Department had plans to unleash a $1 million killing machine robot into the streets of Chicago to fix their problems? There's some gang violence over there. Let's just send this robot in with like four bazookas and machine guns and just kill everybody. Did you notice the line when they're unveiling this police prowler robot to the police department, and they cut to Chuck Norris and he calls it it's another gum without a brain.
Yes.
And it was my epiphany that if Chuck Norris was a Major League Baseball front office guy, he would be anti-analytics for sure.
Oh yeah. Oh, he would have quit the A's in 1999.
Yep.
So here's my question though. So the police prowler, to get it right, is run by what looks like to be a big sort of burdensome remote control, right?
Yeah. It's like almost okay. like a 1986 version of like a tablet or something.
So when Cusack originally takes it to fight the bad guys, he's got the remote control, which makes perfect sense. So he is. But about halfway through, Cusack starts to go fight the fight by himself and drops the remote control completely.
Yeah.
And the police prowler still manages to go through the motions of shooting a machine gun to kill the bad guys and to blow stuff up.
Yeah, he put it in auto mode.
Yep.
Okay, is there... That's what I was going to ask. Yeah, I was never clear...
It's like an air fryer. Do you have an air fryer?
I want one so bad.
I don't have an air fryer.
Yeah, they're great. We got one last Thanksgiving. It's the best purchase of all time.
Everyone says this.
I had like I had four beers in me. We were at McCormick & Schmick's downtown on Black Friday, and we walked across the street to Target at like midnight and said, let's just see if there's any specials. I drunkenly got an air fryer. We use it like three times a week. It's great. And there's like 10 settings.
So tell me more about
how
this works.
There's 10 settings. You can go manual. Yeah. You can say, want it to be this length of time at this temperature, and you can go manual.
Remote control.
But what we do is there's a button for fries. There's a button for chicken. There's a button for seafood.
This is my kind of
cooking. There's different buttons you can push, and it just automatically senses. Like, you put like a bag of frozen sweet potato fries in. You hit the fries button, and then it'll just beep when it's done.
So Cusack did that.
He must have said, there must be a button that says like, drug lord gangs in a warehouse. And you hit the button.
Blow stuff up.
And it knows, like, all right, I got drug lord gangs in the warehouse. I'm busting out the big guns.
Can I find one to target?
I am the police prowler robot.
Which the first thing I thought of
you.
Was Rocky.
Yeah.
Three
Rocky,
or four,
Rocky
right?
four.
Yep. That's the first thing I thought of.
Happy birthday, Polly.
Polly's robot.
Birthday, Polly.
Which Stallone, in retrospect, hates.
Birthday,
and he's
Polly.
Cutting it out of the remake.
No, he can't get rid of it.
He is. He's going to cut that out because he hated it.
Happy birthday, Polly.
Happy birthday, Polly.
That's the first thing I thought of, though, upon seeing the police prowler was Rocky IV.
Now, I'm glad you brought up this whole final warehouse sequence where he brings in the police prowler robot, because I think it's one of the most impressive action movie performances in terms of, all right, you're kind of on your own. You might have a sidekick. It might be a human. It might be a robot, but it's you're outnumbered. There's like 30 of them. They're all dangerous. They all have guns. They're all spread out. And it's up to you, man. Like it's LeBron James against the Golden State Warriors in the finals from 2 years ago. And Kevin Love's hurt. Mm-hmm. And Kyrie's gone. Like, it's on you. And I got to say, it's one of the more impressive, like, Rocky beating Drago, that's a one-on-one matchup.
How does nobody kill him, man? How does Cusack not get killed?
Because he's got Scottie Pippen, the robot, over there just playing defense on everybody.
In the pool hall, how does he not get killed? I love how too.
Someone threw a pool ball at his head.
He did.
They beat him up and throw him down some stairs and like, that'll do him.
Well, no, they told him, they said, you've got until morning to produce Tony Luna. And if you don't, I'm going to kill the girl. So they were trying to keep him alive to go find Tony Luna so that they could tie all the knots.
Tony Luna, by the way, not a great gangster.
No, he's just kind of a coward.
Yeah, he was not a good gangster. And then, of course, his car blows up.
The production company here, if you remember at the beginning of the movie, you saw the old school Orion Pictures production, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is a very 80s and early 90s movie production company. So I looked up Orion, and they did go out of business in the late 1990s. So I think they were founded like late 70s, and then they produced movies into the 90s. So it's a very 80s and early 90s movie production company.
Sure.
And I looked at the list. They've got a full list of Orion movies that were produced over that period. It's unbelievable. How did they go bankrupt is my question. Maybe they didn't. Maybe they
did
got
they
bought
get
out or something.
Bought out or purchased, basically? Well,
let's look it up real quick here. I just want to make sure.
I bet they did.
Orion
Pictures. I bet they got absorbed by a bigger picture house. Or production company, I should say.
Yeah, they...
I bet it was
Since 1997, Orion has been owned by Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Okay. They revived the Orion name in 2013 for TV. So that's good to know because... These movies, like, and this is just a partial list, Caddyshack, Rambo First Blood, Platoon, Hoosiers, Bull Durham, Dances with Wolves, Silence of the Lambs, like, powerhouse production company.
Absolutely.
For like 20 years.
Absolutely.
Did you guys see, here's another one for you, that Chuck Norris, I was doing some Chuck Norris research. So Chuck Norris was a karate champion around the world throughout the late 60s and 70s. Like, he was friends with Bruce Lee, and that's, you know, then he gets into film. So he founded Chun Kuk Do. I got to be careful. I don't want to get in trouble here. Chun Kuk Do was, I guess you would call it a dojo or something. Like, it's a martial arts studio.
Sure.
And it was founded, I believe it was founded while Chuck Norris was training in Korea when he was in the military. So he founded this Chun Kuk Do, which includes a code of honor and rules to live by. Have you ever read the 10 Chuck Norris rules to live by?
No.
This is not a joke or a bit.
Okay.
These are the 10 Chuck Norris rules to live by. Number one, I will develop myself to the maximum of my potential in all ways. Let's grade ourselves, too, in our heads as we go through this exercise and see, are we living up
good
to
hair.
Chuck Norris?
Good hair is imperative.
Yeah, I have good hair.
You do.
Number two, I will forget the mistakes of the past and press on to greater achievements.
Yeah.
Such as a film, maybe, that's not up to snuff anymore. Yeah,
I will continually work at developing love, happiness, and loyalty in my family.
Yeah, I'm good at that.
Okay.
Close to my family, yep.
Number four, I will look for the good in all people and make them feel worthwhile.
Well, then they kill too many people.
I'm not asking you to compare these to the movie you just saw. I'm saying
I'm disappointed.
I can't do that.
Hugh Jack didn't like this.
Once I see bad in someone that I don't like, there's no good.
You're done?
I'm done.
Number five, if I have nothing good to say about a person, I will say nothing.
Nope.
Sorry, Andrew Wiggins.
Yep, I will be mean to people.
Number six, I will always be as enthusiastic about the success of others as I am about my own.
Get out of Hollywood.
I'm in the middle.
You are not. You do not belong in Hollywood with that type of mantra.
Number seven, I will maintain an attitude of open-mindedness.
Yeah.
Unless it's Craigie.
Yeah.
Then I'm just not. You can't plant a gun on a kid like that.
Number eight, I will maintain respect for those in authority and demonstrate this respect at all times.
Oh, yeah. That's. No question.
Number nine, I will always remain loyal to my God, my country, my family, and my friends.
Some of those, yes. Some of those, no.
And number 10, I will remain highly goal-oriented throughout my life because that positive attitude helps my family, my country, and myself. Those are Chuck Norris's 10 rules to live by.
Yeah, the country thing, I'm sort of lost on that one. I'm backing off now.
Okay. So you guys are not batting 1,000.
No.
I am a much bigger fan of Cusack than I am Norris right now, okay? Let's just put it that way.
All right.
Just kick ass, take names.
What other
ambiguous about how old your girlfriend might be.
What other observations before we get to definitive bad guy rankings?
Oh, okay. I got one for you. I'm sure it was on purpose because he's a blue-collar cop, but could we have got the car painted before the movie?
Yeah.
Could we have got the car? He executes.
I don't even remember what the car
is. It's a piece of junk.
It's like an old Camaro or something. But, okay. He executes at one point in the film a perfect Rockford move, which is that spin, go backwards fast, hit the brake, and spin the car, which Rockford did on his show constantly, okay? But Rockford had a 1975, 73, something like that, Camaro. So it was awesome. This piece of crap would have blown up if you tried that move. That the car disappointed me. I'm not saying he had to have a great looking car, but this thing looked like he went to the shop and got it off the lot and was like, I'll drive this.
I legit don't even like remember what color the car was. I can tell you
it was rusted.
It was white with like rust on the rocket panel. It was
yeah. Rocket panel. It's good. Yeah.
All right. Definitive bad guy rankings.
All right.
So far, the best bad guys we have ranked are Hans Gruber from Die Hard, Cyrus the Virus from Con Air, Brad Wesley from Roadhouse, Cobra Kai from Karate Kid, Mr. Joshua from Lethal Weapon, Ivan Drago from Rocky IV, the Russian mobsters from John Wick, Dennis Hopper from Speed, and Bodie from Point Break. Dom from Fast and the Furious is right in there too. The worst ones are the incompetent Russian military from Rambo 3, the muggers from Death Wish, the French drug lord from Bad Boys, Gans and Billy Bear from 48 Hours, and Sloan from Wanted, and then a bunch in the middle, like Le Chief from Casino Royale, Chong Li from Bloodsport's in the middle, the Krupp Senator from Hard to Kill. So I think the bad guys in this movie, and a couple things, we're ranking this based on a criteria of, were they iconic bad guys? Like Hans Gruber's iconic, right? Were they iconic bad guys? Were they effective bad guys? Were they evil bad guys? Did they show charisma as bad guys? So all those are categories. The Camachos and the Lunas, I'm lumping in as all, like, the bad guys are from two
and
rival.
And the Camacho, to me, he was the main one.
Yes.
Because I felt like he was sold more as a competent bad guy.
That's fair.
Yeah.
But I think we have to include the Lunas, too, because they were, so it's the Camachos and the Lunas.
It's a mafia story.
It's a gang and the mafia.
Yeah, okay.
So, I don't know, they're not, like, iconic. They were very effective, but also, like, outnumbered their opponent 30-1 and still couldn't win.
What's the middle group again?
Smack dab in the middle, we have these five, I would say. Dom from Fast and the Furious, Lord Humongous from Mad Max 2, Molaram from Temple of Doom, the rogue CIA agent from The Expendables, angry terrorist Ivan from Air Force One, and the corrupt senator from Hard to Kill. That's kind of your middle ground. I think they belong kind of in that
general area. I'd probably put them near the top of that group.
Okay.
That might be kind, but I thought he was a decent bad guy, but he's not iconic.
See, not like Molaram is more iconic from Temple of Doom because he like reached into the he had a signature move, right? He reached into your heart and pulled into your chest and pulled your heart out. I would probably put him behind Molaram.
I'm fine with that.
I'm cool with that.
Okay,
I'm absolutely fine.
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
Okay,
yeah. good bad guys, but nothing where you said, "Whoa, great bad guy."
Yeah, that's probably fair. All right, now we get to our official Seagal ranking system here, where we rank on a 1 through 10 scale how great this movie was or not. The top movies we have reviewed so far, Die Hard, that's a 10. That's the only 10 across the board. John Wick is a 9.3. Commando is a 9.2. Fast and the Furious and The Expendables, 8.8. Top Gun, 8.7. Roadhouse, 8.5. Hard to Kill, 8.5. Rocky IV, 8.2. And then Bad Boys, Independence Day, and Point Break are all at an 8. At the bottom, the worst movies we have reviewed are Bloodsport is a 3. Mad Max 2 is a 3.7. Wanted is a 3.8. Rambo 3 is a 4. Indiana Jones, Temple of Doom is a 4.7. We'll start with Judd. 1 through 10 scale.
I'm going to give this, and I really enjoyed this film. Like, this was fun. I really, it fit so much of the formula that I love. I'm going to give it a 7.5.
Okay.
I think that's very fair.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd give it a 7.5 too. I was thinking 7 and 8, and I don't think I can give it an 8 because it wasn't iconic, but it fits our bill. And also Chuck Norris. This is like my first ever Chuck Norris film. I think he's excellent.
We got to do another one.
Like,
there's so many. There's like Delta Force.
I know Steven Seagal's like cheesy, but like honestly, Chuck Norris is on a completely different level than Steven Seagal, and I've only seen one of one so far. I get that. So I don't have a big sample size, as the kids like to say. But I think Chuck Norris was phenomenal. So 7.5.
Chuck Norris has a wider range.
Yes.
He's got a wider range for sure.
He's just better. He's just a better
actor. Thespian.
Yeah.
Thespian.
I'm a little higher on it than you guys. This is the first time any of us have seen this movie. I gave it an 8.5.
Okay.
I think Chuck Norris is amazing. And I thought there was enough action. There was a good plot. It was snappy. It didn't drag on. And you had enough cheese ball stuff. So I'm giving it an 8.5, which brings it to a 7.8 overall score, making it the 13th ranked action movie that we have ranked to this point.
Go, Craigie.
It's ahead of Lethal Weapon for us.
Ooh, I'm surprised by that. What was Lethal Weapon?
7.3.
Who did not like Lethal Weapon of us three?
I didn't.
Never mind.
You just said who didn't and you didn't.
I get it. I got it mixed up.
Love Lethal Weapon.
I got it mixed up. I Googled it, saw the image. Yes, I didn't love Lethal Weapon. That's why.
You want to shout the title?
Yeah, it wasn't great. It was okay.
The last scene is so great.
The last scene ruined the movie for me.
I know, which is why I loved it. Okay. That's the difference. It made it for me. It ruined it for you.
So, all right. I think it's Judd's turn.
It is.
Pick for next week.
All right, Judley.
All right. So I'm going to go to a film that actually I think it's pretty good, but it's got flaws, and God bless flaws in films. Running time of 1 hour and 33 minutes, so it's not too long. In fact, it might be just right. From 2008.
Whoa.
Yeah, that's right. I'm going more recent. Taken.
Yes!
With Liam Neeson.
Wow.
I love Taken.
Taken.
All right, I have never seen
what?
Taken.
Oh, you haven't? Oh, you'll... Taken is.
Oh, I love Taken.
I think it's flawed, right, Dex?
Like, so flawed.
Like, it's got flaws, but it's just so enjoyable.
This is one of the first movies ever watched illegally on the internet. And I'm admitting that. That's totally fine. I don't care.
Hold on. I'll call Seagal.
This is great. I love Taken, dude.
It's funny because I've never seen this movie, but I can recite, like, the main speech.
That's right. What I was going to say. That's
a particular set of skills.
Yes. Yeah.
I will look for you, I will find you, and I will kill you. Yeah. I've got a particular set of skills.
I'll say this. It's gonna take you a while as you watch this film unfold, Phil, to get your head around the fact that Liam Neeson is this big a badass.
Right.
Okay.
Like, yes. That's the fun.
Yeah.
Because at first you're like, well, no, really? Really? Schindler's List, right?
Right.
And then you're like, oh my God, yeah, okay, cool.
A particular set of skills.
I did forget this is 90 minutes. I felt like this movie was like 2 hours or something.
But it's quick.
It's been a while since I've seen it.
And it's fun, and it's flawed enough that it fits in perfectly with this segment.
All right, that's a wrap on the 28th edition of Action Movie Rewind.
Go Chuck Norris!
One day, I would like to give you a gift of a Colombian necktie. Very special. You slit the throat, pull out the tongue, and I knew... We're not beautiful. Why don't you give it to me right now?
Patrick Royce, who is the bigger organizational postseason choking franchise, the Twins or the A's?
Well, probably the A's, because the A's have been more consistent in this decade than the Twins have. I mean, we're talking about the Twins being chokers. Let's not forget that the first 6 years of the previous decade were the worst in franchise history. So it's not like I think you have to go back farther to find set up our resume for choking, don't you, than you do the A's. So the A's have been more consistently good than the Twins have. So I'd say the A's.
Yeah.
By the way, all praise goes to Kenta Maeda and Jose Barrios for holding down that team. God almighty, are they swinging the bats? It's unbelievable.
And the good news is they're fresh to make starts this weekend if you need them, Maeda and Barrios, because they only pitched five.
I know.
Wow.
I know. They gave up a combined 2 runs, right?
Yeah, it was real tough.
No, Maeda.
Maeda didn't give up any, did he?
Gave up none. And
they had to come out, Pat.
And Barrios gave up one when it was hit through a little ground ball through the shift that was not a hit. Barrios basically didn't give up a hit because the Gonzalez ball was there, And the thing up the middle is as routine a ground ball as it can be.
So. They feel great for the postseason, though. They feel great for spring training, I should say.
I wonder who gets to start February 29th.
You get Maeda out there ASAP.
I'm going opener. Matt Whistler for an inning.
You know what? Yeah, that's true. Matt Whistler. Astros, Rays. If the Rays can, you know, I have hopes for the Rays tonight because Cole is pitching on. He's never pitched on 3 days rest, I heard. You know, that there might be hope that they can, you know, and they didn't. He didn't dominate them last time, so they might be able to get three or four runs and then piece it together. But I get very nervous about when you're playing the fourth game of a series and you got to go to the opener like Tampa does.
I agree.
Yeah, and you know, did you hang in the game long enough last night to see our pal Aaron Sleggers, another ex-Twin, Oliver Drake,
yep,
John Curtis, and Aaron Sleggers are all on that 14-person pitching staff that Tampa has thrown together. I think a Rays-Astros series would be great. The greatest underdogs in American sports, the Rays, who do it without any fan base and without any payroll, and the Astros, America's villains, who are rubbing it in our face right now. Did you see Maldonado's tweet? Was you wanted us, you got us. And it had 600 and some replies. 500, I only looked at a few, but the sample I took was, they still want the Astros to die because of 2017. So.
And they are your team, Patrick. They are, the Astros are Royce's team.
If they're playing the Rays, I don't know. I love the Rays, too. I love this whole idea that, that they're somehow doing this. I looked it up. I mean, they've been over 90 wins. 5 times or something this decade. They made the playoffs since they went to the World Series out of nowhere in 08. I guess this is only their 6th playoff appearance, but it's incredible when they, you know, they have to give away their good players because they can't pay them, and they, you know, they keep making all these weird moves, and somehow they keep winning. It's incredible.
Also, if the Rays do get through the Yankees tonight and then the Astros, this is probably only for real baseball nerds, but Andrew Friedman is the president of baseball operations for the Dodgers. Yes. Andrew Friedman left Tampa for more money. Hey, take everything you're doing in Tampa and have a $250 million payroll to in Los Angeles, and they might face each other.
Yes. By the way, look at those two lineups. The Braves-Dodgers should be pretty good. Look at those two lineups. Holy cow, those are good lineups. I mean, the Dodgers got 12 guys. They got this catcher, Will Smith, who doesn't even catch all the time. He had 5 hits last night.
Yep.
And a young guy. But their lineup is just fantastic. Now that Bellinger's come out of his coma. And I think Acuna might be the best player in baseball now that he's cut his strikeouts down to, you know, 1 a game instead of 2 a game. So, I mean, he's unbelievable.
So you're
they're really good, Atlanta.
So, Pat, you're saying that striking out all the time might be a bad idea?
I saw Mackey jumped on the no-strikeout bandwagon today. I was proud of you, sir.
Well, listen, let's hash this out.
That was yesterday, too, by the way.
I am on the spectrum of how much do strikeouts matter. I am not in full alignment with Pat, but I do draw a damn line at some point. So let's get that straight. I draw a line. Go ahead.
Did you see the Wall Street Journal piece?
Yes,
that?
Yes.
Yeah. So... yeah, I don't mind if somebody strikes out 120 times or 130 times and plays 140 games, but over 2 a game ain't good.
And Pat, think about when you're just in those 2 games between the Twins and the Astros. Think about how many times the Astros had a couple runners on and a 15-hopper went through to the outfield for an RBI hit or a bloop, right? And the Twins have the bases loaded, and Big Lug comes up and hits a pop-up or strikes. Just being able to put a ball on the ground in a spot where you need to in the playoffs is important.
You know what? And the Astros are an amazing case, Phil, because they were at the start of this launch angle generation. And remember, they were striking out all the time and they were, you know, work the count, do all that stuff, get on base in the mid 2010. They were terrible before that, of course. But and then all of a sudden they decided to start trying to put the ball in play and make more contact and not sit around and wait for walks. And it's worked out pretty good. But they had some guys. They got some guys right now who were absolutely terrible during the regular season. Korea was awful.
Yep.
And now Altuve. Now he's hitting a home run every game. Altuve. Has he been searched for buzzers, Jose? Has he? We don't. But
trash
cans.
We got trash cans.
There's no video to watch, though. They'd have to be, you know, sending these things from outer space now to get their tip offs. But they look really good. But the strikeouts. I was telling Reavers this a couple of days ago. There used to be an old baseball guy named Glenn Gostick, right? And he was a very odd character, but a statistical guy. And he came up with, at the end of each year, back when it wasn't easy, he came up with advanced base runners. How many base runners did you advance by percentage? And that, if you hit a home run, you advanced yourself 4. And whoever else was on, okay? But he came up, he'd send this long, thick sheet of stats at the end of the year. It'd take him about 6 weeks after the season was over, but he'd mail it to you. And his theory was baseball is a game of advanced base runners.
Yeah.
And the players at the top of his list every year, 8 of the 10 were the best players in the league. You know?
Yeah. Advanced base runners avoid outs. Those are your two. Yes.
That's not what Miguel does.
If you can do both of those at once, that's great.
That's not how Miguel lives his life.
No, honest to God, I know we can make jokes here, but what can be done? What can be done?
About Miguel?
This has got to change.
I mean.
No, but nobody wants him. Nobody's that tight.
How are you going to change him?
No,
he changes for 2 weeks. And then ordinarily goes back.
He's also like, I mean, Tom Kelly used to say, right? Once a guy gets to about 2,000 plate appearances,
yes,
kind of is who he is. Yeah. Miguel Sano is at about 2,200 plate appearances. He's 27.
But Phil, now maybe we can give some of this credit to the long layoff and the short buildup. And, you know, maybe he's a guy that needs 70 at-bats in Florida or something. I don't think he's ever had that many. Maybe he needs that. But this is the worst he has ever been. At the prime age of a baseball player, right, 26, 27, at his prime age, this was the worst he has ever been.
So what if, all right, this is just my own harebrained idea. I am not a certified Major League Baseball hitting coach, but I pretend to be one when there's a microphone nearby. So if you just told him, all right, your current approach is to just ignore strikeouts and just swing as hard as you can and swing for home runs. What if you told him your new approach is going to be use your 300-pound frame to just make contact as often as possible? What would happen?
I don't know. You know, but the one service Josh Donaldson could perform with this team, since playing isn't one of them, apparently, would be to have Miguel spend the winter with him in the batting cage to learn how to use right field.
Yeah.
Cruz does it some, but Donaldson is a master of it. And it would be, but, you know, I don't know. Can a guy change? Maybe he can't change. I don't know.
Hey, Patrick, prediction for you for a piece that somebody nationally or locally is going to get right before spring training starts. They're going to try and sell us on, they didn't tell us at the time, but the COVID affected Sano more than we knew. That's my prediction. I think we're going to get some spin on why he was so bad.
Well, he did have the, he didn't get to take BP. He started late, right?
He missed the
first 2 weeks of that game.
He showed up positive.
Oh, yeah, they're going to
spin it.
You know, it's time for them to come out and say, this is not sustainable, and we didn't give him a 3-year contract for this, and, you know, he's got to change. But that's not the way we do that in modern sports. We always make excuses, at least publicly. But I don't know. Do you think the hitting coach is in trouble?
Probably should be. I mean, you know.
He,
I don't know, 60 games in.
And these guys, you know, they'll change stuff. Don't worry about that. They will. All of a sudden, there'll be a little announcement that he's been reassigned or something like that, you know. Because last year, he wasn't really the guy they wanted. They just couldn't hire the outside guys they wanted, so they stayed within the organization. But I don't know. Who did he help? Did we have anyone
this season?
Did we have anyone all season say, boy, Edgar's really helped me?
That's a good question.
Kirilloff looked great in that last playoff game.
Yeah.
Kirilloff.
And he wasn't in St. Paul. Who was the hitting? You know who we need? The goofy guy that was in, look him up. The goofy hitting coach that is now the minor league hitting coach, bearded, crazy background. This guy does. Let's make him the hitting coach. My niece backpacked around Europe with him for 6 months when he got out of college. This guy is, he's got a goofy name like Declan or something.
That's a stupid name.
No, who would name their kid Declan? I'd name my kid Judd before that.
One of their, I can't do it right now, but I guess he is a character and the modern thinker, too.
He's hired. So, he's hired.
Might have to try something else. But anyhow, I watched the Bears last night.
What'd you think?
For a while. Vikings 2-0 against the Bears, 2-0 against the Lions. It's a cinch. They stink.
Oh, that deep.
I don't know, man.
Khalil
Mack might get a win by himself against the Vikings offensive line.
He'll have to with that offense they have. Brutal. Foles.
What's wrong with Nick Foles? I mean, Super Bowl champion right here. We saw it.
I know we did. I do like the fact that the greatest quarterback in the history of the NFL didn't know it was fourth down. That's pretty good.
And then lied.
After the game, wouldn't fess up that he didn't know first.
He and his coach both lied.
I always walk around holding up four fingers when I really mean three. You know, I do that a lot. You know.
Wait, that was his excuse? Did he try to make an excuse that he didn't?
No, he just lied. Answer, you know, he basically was asked if he forgot it. He just went on, and he didn't confess that he thought it was fourth down.
I mean, he did.
He thought it was.
That's amazing.
He did to the nation, whoever was watching, but he did not confess after the game that he thought it was third down.
All right, yeah. Tom. By the way, like if Tom were, this is the thing that bothers me about Brady in that spot. Tom Brady is Teflon at this point. He's the greatest quarterback to ever walk. Everything he does from this point forward is unprecedented, and it's a bonus. And if Tom were to just level with all of us after the game and say, you know what, totally forgot we spiked it on second down there, just 100%, I wouldn't have made that pass on fourth down if I would have known it was fourth down, and I just made a mistake. All right, cool.
Yeah, it would have made you feel better about him as a human being, that's for sure.
Can you imagine if Kirk had done that?
I also think if you're his teammate, you would feel better about him too, wouldn't you?
If Kirk forgot the downs in the first quarter, we would kill him.
Yeah, we would break into the dome to boo him. People would... Those trapeze artists that broke in there last time, and Steve showed us how to break in so we could boo him if he did something like that.
We'd be hanging from the rafters, like they were that day against the Bears.
All right, Pat, we will talk to you.
80 degrees today, boys. I wish I played golf. Unbelievable.
I've got the golf shirt on underneath here. We're going to go.
Are you going?
Go to hit a few later today.
Nice.
Probably wayward. Right. Yep.
I'll be on my couch.
Right.
See you guys later. Bye.
Go get him, Jen.
All right. See you, Pat. Rapping with Royce. You can also find Patrick Royce Unchained, his podcast on Apple, Spotify, and Score.
What would we do to Kirk? If Kirk forgot the downs, which Brady clearly did, I don't care what he or Bruce Arians say, they're lying. He forgot the downs.
He did. And I'm actually okay with that. Whatever. Like, doesn't matter.
But it never happens. Like, when's the last time that you saw a quarterback? I mean, backup.
We've never seen a senior citizen play quarterback before. I mean, he's in his mid 40s,
he's washed.
Could this speak to concussion problems?
He's you and Tom Brady are like basically
He's
the
7
same age.
Years younger than me. He's 43, I'm 50.
Yeah. That's amazing.
I don't forget the downs.
Never.
When I'm in the front yard and Stella's going deep, I know what the down is.
Here's the thing, like I can
she
already
runs
hear
the
people,
nine route, it goes well.
I can already hear people like, you know, like
Yeah, if Kirk Cousins, you guys would savage him. Yeah, because like Kirk Cousins doesn't have 6 Super Bowl championships or whatever it's been.
I still said you can't forget the times. You can't forget the Downs. Then Declan's right.
Tom Brady can forget the Downs.
You know what, Dex? Don't back off. He might be washed. Don't back off.
All right, that's a wrap on this episode of Mackie and Judd. We'll be back with either our pie chart of praise or pie chart of blame, depending on what happens Sunday night between Vikings and Seahawks.